Welcome. This is episode 535 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. In today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the series on the 2024 Step 2 CK Step 3. The 2024 Step 2 CK Free 120. This is going to be part 12. If you've missed the other 11 parts in the series, again, I think it's a pretty good learning experience. We've done the first 90 questions. So today I'm going to go from questions 91 to 100. And if you're kind of wondering, Divine, what are the specific episodes for these topics? I'll encourage you to just literally go on the website, click on exam topics list. You'll see a Google spreadsheet that it leads you to. Go there. Under the Step 2 CK Step 3 tab in the Google spreadsheet, if you scroll, you'll see the different headings where I put like podcasts for the different disciplines, like OB-GYN, psych, neuro, blah, 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 blah. There's literally a section titled Free 120 or whatever, and I put the specific episode numbers. All right, so let's hit up questions 91 to 100. So question 91 says, a 12-month-old girl is brought to the office by her father because of a three-day history of fever and mildly decreased appetite and activity. She has not had cough, vomiting, or diarrhea. She receives no medications. Vaccinations are up to date. She's at the 35th percentile for height, 50th percentile for weight, and 60th percentile for head circumference. Temperature is 39.2 degrees Celsius, that's 102.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Other vital signs are within normal limits. Examination shows no other abnormalities. A catheter urine sample is obtained, and urinalysis shows 20 to 30 white blood cells per high power field, and is positive for nitrites. Oral TMPSMX therapy is begun. The next day, urine culture grows greater than 100,000 colonies per milliliters of Escherichia coli that is susceptible to trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management? Option A says ciprofloxacin prophylaxis, B says clindamycin prophylaxis, C says CT urography, D says ultrasonography of the kidneys and bladder, and E says voiding cystourethrography. But what is this question showing us? This is a pretty simple question. Basically, little kids should not get UTIs. Simple as that. They should not get UTIs. Even women, they shouldn't get UTIs. But boys, especially so, they shouldn't get UTIs. So whenever you see a UTI in a child, you're always worried on the USMLEs about some kind of anatomical defect that may be causing them to have these UTIs. So usually you're going to interrogate that by starting with a renal ultrasound, just to see, because it may show you what's going on. If the renal ultrasound is negative or whatever, then you can go for the VCUG, the voiding cystourethrogram. So option D makes the most sense here as the thing we're going to start with. Okay, option D makes the most sense. If you notice they have this anatomical problem, you figured it out, then you can put them on like daily antibiotic prophylaxis. But until then, we should kind of chill on that. And it doesn't make sense to give Cipro to a kid, right? You probably don't want to rupture their Achilles. Doesn't seem like a good idea. You don't want to prolong the QT interval. And clindamycin is a drug for Staph aureus and anaerobes. It's not really going to be covering many of the gram negatives that cause them. A person to have a UTIs. All right, let's go to question 92. So a 32-year-old man comes to the office because of a two-week history of persistent non-productive cough occurring in short bursts. During the past week, he has had bilateral chest pain with severe coughing. He has vomited several times after coughing vigorously. He has not had shortness of breath or fever. 3 weeks ago, he had a runny nose, sneezing, and mild malaise that resolved spontaneously after 1 week. Toward the end of that period, he noticed the onset of cough, which has since worsened. He has no history of serious illness, and his only medication is over-the-counter cough drops. He drinks 24 to 36 ounces of beer weekly. He does not smoke cigarettes or use other substances. He's sexually active with one male partner. They use condoms consistently. He is 5'8" tall. That's 173 centimeters, and weighs 86 kilograms. That's 190 pounds. BMI is 29 kilograms per meter squared. Temperature is 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Pulse is 70 per minute, respirations are 12 per minute, and blood pressure is 120 over 80. Pulse ox on room air shows an O2 sat of 98%. During the examination, the patient coughs several times. There is no sinus tenderness to palpation and no cervical lymphadenopathy. The oropharynx appears normal. Lungs are cleared of auscultation. Cardiac examination discloses no abnormalities. Which of the following is the most appropriate pharmacotherapy? Before I even look at these answers, this is a pretty classic presentation. We literally see a person that they have what I like to call cough plus, right? They're coughing. And the cough just seems to be especially severe. You see this person, they have cough and chi. They have like bilateral chest pain with their cough. They vomit several times after they cough vigorously. And we notice that, before this person's symptoms started, they had these URI symptoms, runny nose, sneezing, and mild malaise. Well, what does this look like? This sounds an awful lot like pertussis to me. So if this person has pertussis, then the treatment has to be a microlid. Remember, you don't just treat the patient, you have to treat their close partner. So option B makes the most sense, azithromycin. You know, albuterol, no, I'm not going to do that. Again, levofloxacin, no. That's not first line for treating pertussis. Omeprazole is a PPI. That's not really going to be helping you much in pertussis. And prednisone, that's a steroid. Right? We're not going to be using that for pertussis. Okay, now question 93 is one of these HPI questions. Again, I'm not going to drill so deep on this. I feel like I've done a bunch of these. These questions actually tend to be probably like some of the easiest questions you can encounter on the USMLEs, despite all the fear that's associated with them. But this lady is 18 years old and she's in the emergency department. And her reason for a visit is she's coughing up green and yellow mucus. Now, let's kind of go through this HPI, right? So this person has a history of CF, cystic fibrosis, 2 to 3 exacerbations really for the past 5 years. 3-day history of cough productive of copious amounts of yellow and green sputum. Has subjective fever, shaking chills, progressive shortness of breath. Symptoms occurred first only with exertion, but now occur at rest. Sharp left-sided chest pain that she attributes to extended paroxysms of coughing. Symptoms are similar to previous exacerbations. Again, past medical history of cystic fibrosis complicated by bronchiectasis and pancreatic insufficiency. We look at her labs. The pancrelipase, that's pretty much pancreatic enzyme replacement therapy. Takes Dornase alpha, that's to break up the mucus secretions. Ivacaftor is a treatment for CF. Albuterol is needed for pulmonary symptoms. 3% inhaled saline for pulmonary symptoms. Okay, no allergies. Family history, brother also has CF. Psychosocial history, doesn't do any nasty things. High school student. We look at her vitals. Honestly, the only thing that kind of sticks out at me, her pulse is 112 per minute and regular. So she's tachycardic, she's tachypneic, she's a little hypertensive. Her O2 sats on room air, 92%. It's kind of low. Appearance, she's in mild respiratory distress, using accessory muscles, right? Pulmonary diffuse bilateral crackles, you know, whatever. Okay, and we'll look at her labs. Her white count is up. That's the big thing. Every other lab is fine, but 16,400 per millimeter cubed. So she has a leukocytosis, portable chest x-ray, bilateral basilar consolidations with increased interstitial markings. So this person has pneumonia. Simple as that, right? This person has pneumonia. So it says, in addition to beginning broad-spectrum antibiotic therapy, which of the following is the most appropriate next step in evaluation? Well, when you got pneumonia, it probably makes sense, especially for a person that has CF, that has like lots of pneumonias and all that stuff. You probably want to know what you're dealing with, right? So you're going to start with broad spectrum antibiotic therapy. But again, for antibiotic stewardship reasons, it probably makes sense to not just give broad spectrum antibiotics, but you want to figure out what's going on so that you can be more targeted in your therapy. So if we look at the answer choices here, CT angiography of the chest, no, she has pneumonia. We don't need to do that. CT angiography of the chest is for PEs. Option B says serum immunoglobulin concentrations. You do that when you suspect an immunodeficiency disease, but this person has CF. We know what's causing this problem. We don't have to do that. Option C says pyrometry with lung volume measurement. Nah, that's for like asthma and all those things. Option D says sputum culture. I like that answer a lot, so I'm going to go with D. Option E says transbronchial lung biopsy. I'm not worried about cancer here. So remember, people that have CF less than 20, most common cause of pneumonia is Staph aureus. Over 20, Pseudomonas, right? But again, that's the most common. It doesn't mean that that's the only cause. So you got to figure out what's going on here. So we're going to do a sputum culture. All right, so we're going to go to question 94. Okay, a 16-year-old boy comes to the emergency department because of moderate left knee pain and abrasions sustained 2 hours ago in a skateboarding collision. He has a history of occasional injuries sustained while skateboarding, including an injury to the same knee 6 months ago. He says his knee had felt fine until today's injury, and he has been fit and active. The patient has an EXT1 mutation, which is also present in his father. The patient takes no medications, vital signs are within normal limits. Examination shows superficial abrasions over the anterior lateral aspect of the left knee. No effusion or instability is noted in the knee, but there is tenderness to palpation. The patient walks with a limp, but is able to bear weight on the leg. X-ray of the left knee shows 2 1x2 cm bone polyps extending, one medially and one laterally, from the proximal tibia at the level of the closing physis. This is unchanged from an x-ray of the same knee obtained during his previous ED visit 6 months ago. Which of the following is the most appropriate recommendation for activity and additional workups? So option A says biopsy of the polyps and recommendation to bear with as tolerated. Option B says biopsy of the polyps and recommendation for no weight bearing. Option C says MRI of the knee and recommendation to bear with as tolerated. Option D says MRI of the knee and recommendation for no weight bearing. Option E says recommendation to bear with as tolerated, no further workup needed. Option F says recommendation for no weight bearing, no further workup needed. All right, so we look at this question. So this person fell while they were skateboarding, which is a common thing, and the person kind of bruised their knee. And, oh, gee, this knee hurts a little bit, but this person can bear weight on the knee. Their vitals are fine. There's nothing too crazy going on here, right? Again, I know the temptation is to start reading too much into this question, but this person is, like, the question is just telling us that this dude is fine. Just let it go. He fell down on the skateboard. Right? We've all been kids at some point in our lives. We fell down and we got back up. We put a band-aid and continued playing. So chill out, okay? I'm going to go with option E here. Recommendation to bear with as tolerated. No further workup indicated. So I like option E a lot. I'm not going to read much into this. I mean, this person has this EXT1 mutation. It's something that's associated with some genetic disease called a multiple hereditary exostosis. And basically, those people, it's an autosomal dominant disease. It tends to be associated with people having a lot of osteochondromas. Those are like pedunculated masses you find on the surfaces of bone. Again, most times it's benign, although sometimes those osteochondromas can progress to becoming a chondrosarcomas. So you gotta watch out for those. But basically, like we're told here that this person has these polyps and it's unchanged from an x-ray on the same knee. So that means this is not something that's like, or changed and become malignant or whatever, right? So don't read too much into this question. I'm not going to read too much into this question. This kid seems to be fine. So just tell them, just be wise, go back and play. I like option E a lot. So I'm going to pick option E. Okay, question 95 says, a 70-year-old woman comes to the office because of 3 episodes of rectal bleeding during the past 4 days. During each episode, she had the sudden urge to have a bowel movement and then passed a bright red bloody stool. She's not had any chest, abdominal, or rectal pain, palpitations, dizziness, lightheadedness, or black stools. Her most recent colonoscopy 8 years ago showed no abnormalities. She has osteoarthritis treated with daily ibuprofen. She takes no other medications. She's 5'6" tall, weighs 152 pounds, BMI is 25. Her vitals are fine. She doesn't have orthostatic hypotension. I'm going to skip that part. On examination, mucous membranes are moist. The abdomen is soft, non-tender, and non-distended. There's no rebound tenderness or guarding, bowel sounds are normal. Rectal exam shows no stool in the vault. There are no masses. Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis? So this is an old person over 50, having a painless bloody bowel movement. And you see this like a classic pattern. The person feels like they want to poop, but then they poop out blood. That's pretty classic for diverticulosis. So I'm going to go with diverticulosis here. It's going to be option C. A colonic polyp, can cause bleeding. But again, you see this pattern, right? Pay attention to the patterns. That's why if you notice in many of my podcasts, I don't just like give you the facts. No, like I like to give the story, because the story many times is what's going to drive you to the right answer on your exams. I'm not going to pick anal fissure. We tend to find that in people that have like a history of chronic constipation or men having sex with men. This is not a duodenal ulcer. That's going to be more of an upper GI bleed, not a lower GI bleed. Gastritis, very awesome distractor here because of this whole thing about, oh, she takes daily ibuprofen. But again, you can see that this is a clear lower GI bleed. Gastritis causes more of an upper GI bleed kind of a situation. And again, it's not just going to be the most classic thing for the vignette that has been presented to us. And then if there's ulcerative colitis, you're not going to wait till age 70 to start off having ulcerative colitis. No, we're going to have found it in a younger male, okay? So that doesn't make any sense. All right, we're going to go to question 96. So a 14-year-old boy is brought to the office because of a 6-month history of changes in behavior. 2 days ago, the patient and his friends were detained by police, for trespassing on abandoned property and entering an unoccupied house. No alcohol or other substances were involved. The police officer who brought the patient home reported that there was evidence indicating this had not been the first time the boys entered the property. The mother says her son was polite and close with his parents until 6 months ago when he began socializing with a different group of boys in his class. She says the patient is constantly exchanging text messages with his new friends. The group has inside jokes and nicknames for one another. Every weekend, the patient goes out with his friends and argues with his parents about his curfew. At home, he is irritable and shares few details about his outside activities with his parents. He has no history of serious illness and receives no medications. Examination shows no abnormalities. Urine toxicology screening is negative. Which of the following is the most likely explanation for this patient's behavior? Option A says adjustment disorder. B says ADHD. C says conduct disorder. D says oppositional defiant disorder. E says normal development. Okay, so this boy sounds like he started hanging out with the wrong crew and started doing bad things. Sounds like the thing that, unfortunately, a lot of teenagers fall into, a lot of youth fall into. So I'm going to go with option E. This is normal development. This is not adjustment disorder. Adjustment disorder, you're going to see a person that has depression-like symptoms, anxiety-like symptoms, and they faced a stressor like a few days ago. They're not going to meet the real diagnostic criteria, however, for depression or anxiety. This is not ADHD. This is not a child that cannot focus in school or talking out of his turn or things like that in like two different settings. No, that's not what's going on here. And then conduct disorder, right? You're going to see a lot of criminal behavior. And I know some of you may be like, oh, Divine, is this not criminal behavior? This person is trespassing on abandoned property. But again, look at the context. That's the thing that kills people on these exams. They're so rigid. They're so stuck on, oh, this is the criteria. I'm going to stick to this criteria. If you violate this criteria, I'm going to slap this diagnosis on you. Well, that's not the way to take USMLE exams. Because if you practice medicine like that, like an actual physician, you will do so many things for patients that they don't need. You got to understand the context, the spirit behind the situation. This kid just started hanging out with the wrong crew, started having bad behavior. That's all that's going on here. We don't have to do anything beyond that, right? So this is also not oppositional defiant disorder, because this child was polite previously, but we see that, man, he started hanging with the wrong friends and boom, everything went berserk. This is normal development. I'm going to go to option E for that. The parents should probably do their jobs. Okay, now question 97 says a six-year-old boy is brought to the ED by his mother because of the acute onset of 1 hour ago of severe right-sided lumbar pain and 3 episodes of MSS. The pain is sharp and causes him to double over and cry. Medical and family history is unremarkable. The patient takes no medications. He's very tachycardic. I'm not going to be reading all these vital signs. He's tachycardic. He's tachypneic. His blood pressure is okay. He appears to be in severe pain. Abdominal examination discloses right upper quadrant tenderness to palpation. The remainder of the examination discloses abnormalities. IV morphine is administered and results in improvement in the patient's pain. Results of dipstick urinalysis are shown. So look at the urinalysis, and the urine specific gravity is pretty high. It's pretty high. And then we also notice that, oh, there's 4+ blood, 1+ leukocyte esterase, 5 to 10 white cells per high power field, but 50 to 100 red blood cells per high power field. Renal ultrasonography shows severe right-sided hydronephrosis with moderate hydroureter to the bladder. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in evaluation? So what is this? Sudden onset, flank pain. You look at the urine, a ton of blood in it. Sounds an awful lot like a kidney stone. When you have a kidney stone, especially when it's this severe, you're seeing hydronephrosis. Generally, for kidney stones, you want to do a CT of the abdomen, a non-contrast CT of the abdomen, right? You don't want to use contrast, if not, it's going to obscure the stone. You want to do a non-con CT of the abdomen. So I'm going to go to option B here. Most of the other answers are pretty ridiculous. The only other answer that maybe looks good at all is, oh, voiding cystourethrogram. But you do that with UTIs. Again, that's the context. A little child that shouldn't have UTIs having UTIs. You're going to do that to interrogate for anatomical problems. So I'm going to go to option B here. All right, question 98. A 20-year-old man comes to the office. And many of the other tests, radionuclide cystography, retrograde pyelography, MAC3 renal scan with furosemide. Again, those things are rarely ever correct on any USMLE exam, right? When you're picking those answers, you better have some very sound reasons for doing that. Those are answers that I probably will, almost under no circumstance, pick on the USMLEs. They're usually pretty wrong. That's like consulting the ethics committee in a sense. All right, so question 98 says, a 20-year-old man comes to the office at the end of the summer because of a 2-month history of generalized malaise, fatigue, intermittent cough productive of whitish sputum, and decreased appetite. During this time, he has lost approximately 10 pounds. The patient previously was on the college track team, but now feels winded when he tries to go running. He has a history of childhood asthma. He currently takes no medications, doesn't smoke, doesn't drink, doesn't use other substances. He's African American. Of course, they're going to put sarcoidosis as an answer. Yep, they did that. All right. Because they know that, again, if you don't look at context and you're just like, ooh, African American, I'm sure they have sarcoidosis waiting for you. But hey, let's read the rest of the question. Ooh, he has been working at a lumber mill for the summer. Okay. Fitting logs into a saw. He is 5'10" tall, 170 pounds. BMI is fine, 24. His vitals, honestly, are pretty okay. Diffuse crackles are heard bilaterally. The remainder of the examination shows no abnormalities. Chest x-ray shows a reticular nodular pattern that is more prominent in the upper lung field. Results of pulmonary function tests show a mixed obstructive and restrictive pattern, which of the following is the most likely diagnosis? You see this person, all these problems started since they started working at a sawmill, at a lumber mill, so they're exposed to all these inhaled things. Whenever you're exposed to inhaled things and it's kind of torching your lungs and you're seeing this restrictive picture, you always want to think about hypersensitivity pneumonitis. You can be exposed to bird droppings. You know, there are many variants of this, bird fanciers lung, blah, 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 blah. And many times, especially when it's been going on for weeks, like it has a chronic period associated with it, it's going to affect the upper lobes of the lung. It's going to affect the upper lobes of the lung. It's going to affect what? The upper lobes of the lung. That's the more prominent distribution. So I'm going to pick option C here. Aspergillosis doesn't make any sense. We don't see any aspergillosis results. We don't see any elevation in eosinophils in this question, so we're not going to do that. Asthma recurrence, no. We can see that his problems literally started after he started doing this lumber mill job. He should probably quit. Option D says sarcoidosis. You're going to pick that if you just read this question and ignore everything else but the African-American part. That's not a smart way to take exams. And silicosis, right? You're going to be working with sand and all those things. That's not what's going on here. All right. Almost done. Question 99. A 32-year-old woman is admitted to the hospital because of a 2-year history of intractable seizures. Her boyfriend, who has accompanied her, describes the seizures as episodes of bilateral limb shaking and moving her head from side to side, during which the patient closes her eyes and cries. The episodes last 15 to 20 minutes, and she's intermittently responsive during this time. Trials of phenytoin, carbamazepine, gabapentin, oxcarbazepine, and divalproex have not provided relief of her symptoms. Her current medications are zonisamide and pregabalin. The patient has a history of childhood sexual and physical abuse. That's a hint. Vital signs are within normal limits. Neurologic exam shows no focal findings. The patient undergoes long-term video EEG monitoring, which shows that her seizures are not associated with any EEG changes, which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management, right? So option A says CBT. Option B says hypnotic therapy. Option C says increasing the dosage of pregabalin. Option D says psychoanalytic therapy. Option E says surgical resection of the epileptogenic focus. So see this person, they have seizures. Seizures. But this person has a psych history, right? Sexual and physical abuse. This person has a history of abuse in the past. And we see this person's seizures kind of weird. This person, you know, they're aware intermittently during the seizures, and they don't seem to have much of any post-ictal phase. And then we see the EEG shows that seizures are not associated with any EEG changes, right? These are psychogenic seizures. So these are psychiatric problems. This person is going to get CBT for that. I'm going to pick option A. Hypnosis is almost never correct from the USMLEs. We don't need to increase the dose of pregabalin. These are not real seizures. Psychoanalytic therapy is like some stuff that you try to bring a person's unconscious thoughts to the conscious realm. That's something that's almost always going to be wrong on your exams as well. And option E, no, we don't need to surgically resect. This is like psychiatric problem. Okay, this is our last question. So a 2-year-old girl is brought to the, and they put a chest x-ray here. Okay, fine. A 2-year-old girl is brought to the clinic by her parents for an initial examination. Medical records show that she has a cleft palate and VSDs that have not been repaired. During the past 18 months, she has had 2 episodes of pneumonia and at least 10 episodes of otitis media, treated with antibiotic therapy. You see these many infections, you have an immunodeficiency disease. All right. The patient's parents recently adopted her from China. She's at the 10th percentile for height, 5th percentile for weight. Yeah, this is definitely an immunodeficiency disease. Vital signs are within normal limits. Examination shows middle ear effusions bilaterally and a cleft palate. Lungs are cleared, auscultation agreed. 3 out of 6 holo systolic murmur is heard on cardiac exam. So that's the VSD. There's no hepatosplenomegaly. Chest x-ray is shown. Complete blood count is most likely to show which of the following leukocyte findings in this patient. Right. So we see a person having recurring infections and they have cleft lip, cleft palate. They have these craniofacial abnormalities. What do you think that person has? That's the George syndrome. That is literally the George syndrome, right? And again, notice, I didn't even talk about the chest x-ray, but fine, let's talk about it, right? So look at this chest x-ray. Well, this is the George. Look at the top of the chest x-ray. Do you see any big glob of white representing the cell sign of the thymus? No. And it may not be a perfect cell sign, especially for this 2-year-old, but you're probably still going to be able to visualize the thymus. It's not there. It's literally not there. This is the jaws. So what's the pathophys behind the jaws? Well, your third and your fourth pharyngeal pouches, they don't develop. So you guess what? You have no thymus, so you have no T cells, right? And you have no parathyroid, so you don't make BTH. Right, because you have no T cells, you're going to struggle with lots of infections. And many people will think that, oh, it's only viruses and fungi you're going to be struggling with. No, the thing is, you need your T cells to also kind of work with your B cells, kind of stimulate them, especially those helper T cells. So you're going to have some bacterial stuff going on in your life as well. So again, if you don't have T cells, your lymphocyte count should probably be down. So I'm going to go with option C here. Option A, eosinophilia. Again, there's not many immunodeficiency diseases that track with that. Lymphocytosis, not really. Neutropenia, not really. Neutrophilia, not really, right? This is like a pretty clear-cut case of DeGeorge syndrome. So I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, I hope you found this podcast to be helpful. I have a bunch of classes for step two, step three coming up. Step one to step three actually coming up soon. Within the next 2 weeks, I have a test taking strategies class. I have a biostats class. I have a social sciences and ethics class. Those are all for step one to step three. I had a separate podcast where I discussed these classes. And then I have a last minute review, 3 hours long for step two, step three, also coming up this month. I have a 20-hour class for step two, step three, coming up this month. And the next month, I have a 50-hour class. It's only going to be held once this year because it's such a class that requires a lot of commitment. But there's a lot of... It's going to be a class that, if you attend it, is going to be very, very well worth your while. The people that attended it last year, I've gotten so many awesome testimonials from them. And then in July, the first week in July, I'm having a 25-hour step one class. So if you're interested in any of these classes, they're all over Zoom. And if you like the way I teach, that's how those classes are. It's not me teaching lectures. No, it's me using questions and scenarios to teach you content, explain pathophase, make integrations, to really prepare you for an exam the way you're supposed to be prepared for an exam. I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and COMLEX exams. And then I have this podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. I have a YouTube channel you can check out. And then I have another website called divineinterventionlifelessons.com. Every week I post about two podcasts where, from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson and also help with ERAS applications and personal statements and, you know, the likes. So if you're interested in any of those things, just shoot me an email and I can give you some more information. You can email me directly through the website. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you in episode 536. God bless you. Have a wonderful day. Bye for now.